And police made serious errors in its inquiry into Gracie Spink's allegations. She was stabbed to death as she tended her horse in Derbyshire in 2021. Her former colleague, Michael Sellers, was later found dead nearby. Detective Superintendent Darren Diath says the force will learn lessons.
But simply, as a force, we failed Gracie. And for that, I can only offer my own and the force's most sincere apologies.
Five current and three former police officers are being investigated over the investigation into Grindr serial killer Stephen Port. The Independent Office for Police Conduct says they face allegations of gross misconduct. The Palestinian Red Crescent claims one of the last hospitals functioning in northern Gaza has come under attack by Israeli tanks. The aid group says fighting at the Al-Ali Baptist Hospital is so severe its teams can't reach those who need help. We can't verify those claims and Israel hasn't commented. Surgeon Ghassan Abu Sitter worked there but says he's had to leave.
Bombing and the shelling were so close to the hospital, literally in the areas adjacent to the hospital. We've had to leave the wounded people. There are hundreds of wounded there.
Scotland's health secretary has admitted his sons were watching football matches on his parliamentary iPad as he ran up a roaming bill of nearly £11,000. Michael Matheson's apologised to MSPs. Burberry says the cost of living crisis is finally starting to hit its wealthy customers. The fashion company says it's seeing a global slowdown in demand for luxury goods. And Scotland are trailing Georgia in their Euro 2024 qualifier 1-0. They've already secured their spot at next summer's tournament in Germany. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
This is Phoenix FM.
Thanks, Kat.
Weather on Phoenix FM, proudly sponsored by SEHBAC, the award-winning home improvement company for windows, doors, conservatories and extensions.
Well, it is pretty miserable outside. It is definitely a November evening. Any rain that is lingering will spread eastwards through the evening and disappear in the early hours. Tomorrow, cloud clears and it will be turning dry and bright with the odd bit of cloud in the afternoon. Lows tonight are 3 degrees centigrade. Highs tomorrow of 9 degrees centigrade. Just looking forward to the weekend. Saturday, windy with heavy rain moving in from the west. Wonderful.
Weather on Phoenix FM, sponsored by SEHBAC, the award-winning home improvement company, proudly serving Essex for over 50 years. Contact us on 0800 666 444 or visit sehbac.com for help with your home.
My thanks to Joe for Drive. Safe journey home, my friend. From now until 7 o'clock, cricket with me, Darren Mutu, and 98 Not Out.
On 98 FM and online, this is Phoenix FM.
Cricket, lovely cricket. Welcome along to 98 Not Out. I'm in a real rush tonight, so I've got to spin a few plates. So bear with me. Welcome along, as always, every Thursday between 6 and 7. A roundup of all the local, national and international cricket news. Tonight's guest later on is Chris Stocks from the Independent newspaper. We'll have news from the World Cup, which is still going on, but it's nearly finished.
Cricket, lick the ball before it reach the wicket. And we say cricket, lovely cricket. Got to lick the ball before it reach the wicket.
There's a lot of county news going on as well, as everyone assembles back from their summer break, or what they had of it. There's a few comings and goings and a bit of contract news.
It's against the wall.
Music tonight from Ian Brown and from Sheik.
Talking in a different style. Bankaja Thomas in a
Liston style. But I just am a in a Liston style. Come let me tell you about the man I call Michael Olin. Man under Oli Pabolin. Come let me tell you how the man called Michael Olin.
And of course you are listening to Phoenix FM. If you are in the Essex area on the 98 dial, on your FM dial. Via the internet, phoenixfm.com. You can shout at your smart speaker to play your Phoenix FM. That works, I tried that the other day. And if you haven't got time to listen tonight, remember you can download the show later on by heading to the phoenixfm.com website. Look under programs, look under 98 Not Out. And you can listen back. And don't forget to head to the podcast and on YouTube as well.
In a different style. Man called Jah Thomas in a rubber duck style. Man called Jah Thomas in a different style.
And remember, if you want to get in touch, take part with the show, in the show, you can email radio@phoenixfm.com, title your mail 98 Not Out. Anything you want to talk about or comment on tonight's programme, you can use social media messaging. We are on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. You can use all of those to message me. And of course, if you know me personally, you can WhatsApp or text me, like Dan Hagger has just done. And Dan is just having a quiet snifter after a hard day's work. Evening to you, Dan, and I'm sure it's all very, very well deserved. Cricket birthdays of the week. That's one of those weeks where it's a bit quieter. We'll start off with Adam Gilchrist, who I can't believe is 54. Henry Nichols from Derbyshire, 32. A wonderful Andrew Graham Pollock, 54 as well. How do these guys get so old? David Fulton, once of Kent and latterly of Sky Sports, 52. Waka Yunus, 52. Also from Pakistan, Mushtaq Ahmed, 37. Enric Nortia, sadly missing from the World Cup. He's 30. Graham Ford, 63. Aaron Finch, 37. Yusuf Pathan, 41. Mr. Arfan Akram, 40. You don't look a day over 42. And last but not least, it's Dinesh Chandamal. He's 34. Happy birthday to all of you guys. And of course, remember, if you want your birthday or someone you know's birthday read out on the show, use the email or the messaging functions I told you about a minute ago to get in touch and let me know. And I will add you or your nearest and dearest birthday to our birthday list. You can be read out amongst all those wonderful people like that.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.
I've got to say hi to my daughter, Tallulah, who has just saved my bacon because I was in such a rush to come out tonight. I didn't manage to upload all of tonight's content onto my station mainframe. So just when I logged in, when the news was playing at 6 o'clock onto my page in the studio, there was nothing there. If you want the definition of panic, you should have seen my face then. And thanks to Joe as well for trying to calm my hysteria down. But I'm all okay now. Let's have some music while I'm just recovering my composure. This is Ian Brown, and this is F-E-A-R.
forget everything and remember. Everybody and remember.
How you got this turned up?
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
Ian Brown and F-E-A-R. I've now finally regained my composure. The reason being that I was in a real rush tonight. I finished work and got myself down to the station. In my haste, I'd forgotten to upload my content for tonight's show onto the studio mainframe. And only realised as soon as Joe had handed me over and I was just queuing up the news, and then I logged into my page, there was nothing there. Thank goodness my daughter was sat on the computer at home and I managed to walk her through via text about what I needed, and she's done it. So Tallulah, many, many thanks. You have saved my bacon, and saved the bacon of you, the listener, because otherwise you'd have had to listen to me flannelling away for an hour. But have no fear, normal service has been resumed. Let's hear from Hugh Turbeville. Come on, Hugh.
The December issue of the Cricketer magazine is out now, and we look back at England's disastrous World Cup campaign. Vic Marx says England wrote off 50-over cricket and paid the price, while George De Bell argues that Rob Key is under pressure for the first time. Editor Hugh Turbeville, meanwhile, argues that England seem to be winging it at the moment, while Barney Roney writes his final column for The Cricketer from the World Cup. And Nasser Hussain picks out where England went wrong. We also have an exclusive Stuart Broad interview. David Gower pays tribute to Sir Alistair Cook. We have an interview with Yorkshire's Finlay Bean and Darren Goff. And Mike Selvey pays tribute to Bish and Beddy. That's the December edition of The Cricketer magazine, out now.
I strongly suggest you subscribe to that. Go online, go to thecricketer.com and get involved. That sounds like a fantastic issue. Well done, Hugh. Your content is even better than 98 Not Out. I can't believe it. Some fantastic names there and some interesting articles. So out now, make sure you get a hold of it and maybe give it as a give a subscription as a present to someone. Good idea.
Go to phoenixfm.com and listen to online guest interviews. Check the events for your area and listen to great radio online.
Now, after 658 years, 3 weeks and God knows how many days, the Cricket World Cup is reaching a climax this weekend. We now know that the 2023 edition will be contested between India and Australia as the second semi-final concluded barely an hour ago, with Australia beating South Africa in probably the most exciting game, I would say, of the tournament so far. Too many games have been one-sided and just a bit of a bore fest. The whole thing's dragged on too long. More about that later on. But Australia, for the record, beat South Africa by 3 wickets. At one stage this morning, South Africa, who batted first, they were 24 for 4, and the whole thing looked like it was going to be all over in a couple of hours. But a great innings from Klassen, 47, and particularly Miller, 111, saw them post a reasonably defendable title. And as Australia seemed to make hard work of it, they started off really quickly, but then lost wickets at crucial intervals, and it was a bit of a nail-biter going to the end. And there were drop catches, there were yes-no runs, and near run-outs. But Australia got there in the end, so it's setting up for probably the final that, at the start of it, we would have probably guessed it would be. I think all England fans, even die-hard England fans, knew that it was probably a bridge too far for this current England team. We were probably expected to get to the semi-final, but we all know that wasn't to be. That's another story. So can India, who have been like a juggernaut all the way through this, they've won every single game, they're going to be in front of 130,000 screaming India fans at Ahmedabad on Sunday. But can Australia spoil the party? But it's a tricky one, this, isn't it? Because who do you really want to win? Do you want it to be India, who kind of like, you know, bullied their way through this? It's all been kind of put in their favour, allegedly. Pitches have been very friendly. Crowds have only turned up when India are playing, etc., etc., etc. And even a bit curious how Kohli seems to score hundreds, one on his birthday, one on Diwali, and then in the semi-final he scored his 50th ODI 100 as well. I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek with that. I mean, he's a great player. But India are there. But can Australia upset the celebrations? But then do we want Australia to win? Are we Aussie fans? Not really sure about that. But anyway, the final starts on Sunday morning. And the good news is that if you don't have Sky, it is on free-to-air television. It'll be on Channel 5, who have been showing the highlights. Actually, record the highlights. I would say watch it, but don't, because you'll be listening to John Chum and the non-league hour. But record the highlights on Channel 5, because today's game really was a classic. It was a really good example of one-day cricket, and a real ebb and flow, and really, really well worth a watch. So that's on Channel 5 tonight. I think it's on at about 7 o'clock, so make sure you give it a listen.
98. This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Now, there's some other news from the World Cup which is going on. Now, Babar Azam, the Pakistan captain, he's resigned as captain across all formats after being in the job for 4 years. He feels that the time is right. And will continue to represent his country across all three formats. General consensus seems to be that that's a sensible and wise decision, and his timing is good. So he's being replaced by Shan Masood as the new test captain, and Shaheen Shah Afridi will lead the T20 side. I'm not sure if he's also in charge of the ODI side, but certainly in charge of the T20 side. So well done, Baba Azam, and I'm not sure if he's back at Somerset next year or not. We'll have to find out. I'll keep an eye on that one through the calendar. If you do know, let me know. Radio@phoenixfm.com. Title your mail and 98 not out. England batter Ollie Pope and uncapped seamers John Turner and Josh Tongue have been picked in the new-look England squad for their white ball tour of the West Indies. It's non-stop, isn't it, with England? One thing after another. They've been at this World Cup, which was hot on the heels of a home series with New Zealand, which was hot on the heels of a series against Ireland. Probably one of the talking points amongst cricket fans when they're sat down the pub over a pint with their mates about the amount of cricket that is expected of England players these days. Anyway, off to the West Indies. December's tour will be England's first action following their World Cup exit. Only six players in the World Cup squad have been selected for the three one-day internationals in the Caribbean. Moeen Ali, Adil Rashid and Chris Wokes have been dropped for the ODIs but are included for the T20 leg. Well, David Milan has been left out entirely. Strange decisions. A 36-year-old opener was England's leading run scorer during the World Cup campaign, which ended last Saturday with a consolation victory over Pakistan. Rob Key said, "We believe Milan has not had the best form in T20 cricket, so we're being pretty honest with him. I said, you've got to get back to what made you rank number one in the world 2 or 3 years ago." Speaking on Sunday, Key stopped short of ending any player's white ball career, despite calls for England's ageing 50-over side to be rebuilt. He said, "I don't think I'm ever really getting to the point where you're just going to say that people are done completely. At the moment, other people are getting an opportunity like they did a few years ago." That's after the early exit in the 2015 World Cup. "And we got such exciting talent to go out there and become the next great England team." Josh Butler remains as captain for both squads in the Caribbean, with Harry Brook, Gus Atkinson, Sam Curran, Liam Livingstone and Brydon Cast the other players to keep their places from the World Cup. Rhys Topley, who had a brilliant World Cup until he unfortunately got injured, returns for the five-match T20 series after that finger injury. Ben Stokes is out because he's due to have knee surgery next week, and David Willey is retired from international duty now that England's World Cup campaign is over. Now, England, after that, they get Christmas and New Year out of the way, and then they're off to India for a test series in January. That's not having played any test matches since July, so a six-month gap. So I wonder how this will go, India, of all places. Johnny Bairstow, Joe Root and Mark Wood have all been arrested for the white ball stuff with that series in mind, rather than them being dropped. Ollie Pope, who has not played since injuring his shoulder in the second Ashes test in June, is in line for his first white ball cap and is joined in the ODI squad by test teammates Zach Crawley and Ben Duckett, along with 19-year-old Rayan Ahmed and fellow spinner Tom Hartley. Surrey opener Will Jackson and Lancashire's Phil Salt at further freshness despite playing regularly for England in white ball cricket in recent years. The T20s will act as preparation for England's defence of the T20 World Cup in the Caribbean and the United States in June of next year. So that's not going to make a mess of our season, is it? There is no place in either squad for Jofra Archer, whose career has been hampered yet again by back and elbow injuries.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
Right, I shall bring on my guest for this evening. I just caught up with him earlier on today. He's just got back from being in India covering the World Cup, and a really good chat, covering quite a lot of ground actually. So sit back, relax and listen to cricket writer for The Independent, Chris Stocks. Chris, welcome along. Good to see you. And fresh off the plane back from India, I gather.
Yes, I am, Darren. Thanks for having me.
Lots to talk about. We'll get on to England in due course. But I just wanted to talk, everyone that I've known that has been over to the World Cup this time has got stories of travel disruption, badly organised games, and struggling at the stadium with entry and overzealous stewards, etc., etc. What are your thoughts on sort of overall how it all went?
I think the from an organisational point of view, it's been pretty suboptimal. I mean, you think tickets weren't released until what, 6 weeks, 2 months before the tournament began. I've heard countless stories of fans who've travelled over to India struggling to get into the ground because they have a ticket on their phone, or they think's a ticket on their phone, and they're told, nope, you've got to go 5 miles away to collect a paper ticket, come back. And when they come back, they can't take bags in, so they have to go back to their hotel, come back to the ground, and yeah, they've missed half the game. I know several fans who've had issues with A, with tickets, and B, sort of overzealous security, meaning that they've had, you know, missed a lot of the games, and it's just been, you know, not ideal for a fan in the stadium. It's really a TV tournament. If you really want to get down to the basics of it, it's the BCCI and the ICC have staged this for a global television audience, but it's the paying spectators on the ground who are treated like dirt, really.
Yeah, I heard stories of people having bottles of water confiscated, sun cream confiscated, and being told they could buy them inside the ground. But when they got in, they couldn't find anyone that was selling all those things.
Yeah, I mean, it is ridiculous. I mean, some of my colleagues, media, have been told they can't take laptops into the ground, and they've had to find the ICC media manager to tell the security that actually, no, they're working, they need a laptop to get in. It's been pretty chaotic. I know in Mumbai, Don Topley, who was there to obviously watch Reece before he had to unfortunately come home injured from the tournament, he had an issue getting into the ground in Mumbai. They wanted to basically take all his food and his medication off him. And, you know, he was protesting that, you know, look, I'm a player's father, please allow me to take it in. And they weren't having any of it. So it's kind of, they'd be fairly equal on it, you know. Doesn't matter who you are, you're not bringing certain things in, but it just seems a little bit unnecessary, and it just makes the fan experience at the grounds just, you know, unpleasant, really.
Yeah, and as you say, it was, if it was being kind of designed as a television event, it doesn't look good on TV screens. It was widely commented over here that certainly as the tournament got underway, and particularly the England's opening game at Ahmedabad, was basically in front of a handful of spectators. It was almost akin to watching a day two of a county championship game on some sort of a distant county ground somewhere. It wasn't a good look, particularly on the opening game.
Yeah, the opening game, because the stadium is so vast in Ahmedabad, it looked worse than it was. But, you know, the ICC gave an official attendance for that match of 55,000. I was in the stadium. I'm telling you, it wasn't 55,000. Most people estimated maybe 25,000. And that was after a good few hours where people did start coming after they'd finished work and it filled up slightly. But that opening game didn't set the right tone. Attendances for some other neutral games, especially the England games that I went to, weren't actually that bad. Mumbai, for example, when they played South Africa, that was a fairly decent attendance. I reckon 4/5 of the ground was full. England, Australia back in Ahmedabad was much better. But you look at some of the games, you know, the level of attendance was not great, was it? I mean, the fact that tickets would be so hard to come by and it was all so last minute has led to that. But you think in India, a country that's so passionate about cricket, that you'd have sellout games for, you know, for most of those group stage matches at least.
Well, that was the thing. And also, the fixtures weren't released until a month before. So if you're travelling from England or Australia, you know, from one of the more far-flung countries, I wouldn't say West Indies, but we won't go there, you know, you've got to get yourself organised. And if you don't know where your team's playing, it's not good, is it? And it is a World Cup. And as we're constantly reminded about India being so passionate about cricket, you would have thought that people would have been falling over themselves to go and watch any World Cup match in their country.
Yeah, you would do. I think a part of the problem as well is that the tickets have been quite expensive, especially if you're Indian, where, you know, the cost of living over there is much cheaper than the UK. And some of the tickets, especially for the India games, have been, you know, £100 upwards, and you know, to your average Indian cricket fan, that is a hell of a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money for people from the UK to go to cricket, but the prices haven't helped. Just overall, the organisation of this event has just been very, very poor, I would say. For a world event, it should be much better. And the fixtures should have been given much longer in advance. And the fact is, yeah, fans haven't been able to make proper plans. When they have, they've been last minute. And it's just all left a bit of an unpalatable taste in the mouth, to be honest with you, Darren.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, the last World Cup that was over here, 2019, I went to quite a lot of games and that, and everywhere I went was packed, and fans just wanting to be part of a sort of a cricketing festival. I mean, a festival was sort of how it felt. And obviously, as you got to the sort of the final stages, then it became a bit more sort of edgy. But people were there to support it. I just don't understand why India, of all places, it's been such a struggle. But I guess for the reasons you've just said, that maybe that contributes.
Yeah, and 2019 was a fantastic event. It was well run as well. What you've got to remember is the grounds in England are a lot smaller than you have in India. So if you have a stadium that holds 100,000, 110,000, or even 60,000 in Calcutta and it's half full, it doesn't look great, does it? But you've still got a decent number of fans coming through the gates. The ICC estimate 1 million fans have gone to the games so far. But I would take the ICC figures with a pinch of salt, because they've been reluctant to give out attendances for games. Even when they've been specifically requested, they refuse to give an attendance figure because the BCCI will not give them the attendance figure for whatever reason that is. It's just all not very transparent and, as I said earlier, a bit suboptimal.
They're not transparent about anything, really, are they? I remember Jared Kimber's excellent film, Death of a Gentleman, which was a constant battle to try and get some kind of clarity on. And I think from that point of view, it was about finances and how tour programs are scheduled. But it was pushed back almost physically and, you know, literally in trying to get information out of the ICC. It was very much a closed shop.
Yeah, the remarkable thing about the lack of transparency from the ICC was the story that came out of the England-India game in Lucknow, where before the start of play, the UK journalists were all briefed by a member of the ICC comms team that actually it was the top eight of the World Cup that qualified for the Champions Trophy. England had no idea. They found out during the game. This decision had been made apparently in November 2021, but the ICC had not told anybody. They'd not released it to the media. They'd not released anything to anybody. They told people in the meeting there what was happening, but because of the turnover in the ECB, everyone's gone since then. It was never communicated to the team or anyone in team management. It was remarkable, really. But it just goes to show that lack of transparency and lack of communication from the ICC a lot of the time.
Yeah, and yeah, England did look perilously close to sort of missing out completely. I think they've done enough to qualify for the Champions Trophy. So let's get on to England. Now, we were talking about the poor organisation of the tournament itself, but England's defence of that glorious day at Lord's back in 2019, it seems ever since then that 50-over cricket in this country has kind of been sort of sidelined. It was almost like, well, we've won the World Cup, so we'll just concentrate on other stuff now. And even into this year and this summer, there wasn't any sort of urgency about an upcoming big tournament. Have you got any thoughts on why that was particularly?
I mean, you can look at schedules. There was a backlog of one-day tours in particular because of COVID, which were shoehorned into the calendar. So you had a tour of South Africa in January of this year, and then a tour of Bangladesh in March, which sort of overlapped both ends of the New Zealand Test Tour. So it made it impossible for England to select their full-strength squads for either of those one-day series because they had the Test squad in New Zealand. So Ben Stokes, Joe Root, Mark Wood, they were all in New Zealand. They couldn't physically get to South Africa or Bangladesh. Rob Key mentioned at the end of the tournament, the morning after the Pakistan game, to us that he took a lot of the blame because he prioritised Test cricket and told Matthew Mott, the white ball coach, sorry, mate, you can't have your top players for some of these series. That was a symptom of, I guess, of 50-over cricket not being taken seriously enough by the ECB or England. I mean, circumstances did dictate that they're unable to be as organised and as thorough in their planning as they were between 2015 and 2019. But you've got to say as well that the organisation on the ground with the team in India and some of the decision making left a lot to be desired as well.
Yeah, the preparation. I know that there was a bit of chat about the immediate preparation to the tournament, but playing Ireland and New Zealand at home, whether those games, or certainly the New Zealand game, could have been moved to the subcontinent in some way, shape or form. But I'm guessing, I'm reading that county championship fixtures meant that that couldn't happen. I'd probably put a question mark against that because of the players involved. How many county championship teams would that necessarily have gone with? But since we had this brave new dawn with Rob Key and Stokes and McCullum and all of that, one thing that I seem to have picked up on is preparation seems to be a running theme. You know, it's all flattered by these amazing performances, particularly in Test match cricket. But, you know, we started the Ashes, certainly the first two tests, very much undercooked. Finally, once we got going, then it became a real thrilling nail-biting series, which all Ashes series should be. And in this World Cup, it looks like England was sleepwalking into the first six or seven games, and it was only once they got to the fag end of their fixture schedule that they started playing like the England we sort of know that they can be. Are we playing too much cricket? Are there too many distractions to prepare properly for big tournaments?
Are we playing too much cricket is a perennial question, isn't it, Darren?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is yes, they're playing way too much cricket. England play more than any other country in the world. You look at the number of test matches, the number of one-day internationals, the number of T20s, and just tours in general. England are playing, you know, the limit of their capacity that they can. There is only so much all format players can take, you know. They're not robots. They need to have rest. And if they're not rested properly, look at, you know, Ben Stokes with his knee, Jofra Archer with that elbow problem. Players break down. I would say in terms of the World Cup, you look at New Zealand, they went to Bangladesh for an ODI series before it started. Australia were in India playing a one-day series. I think it's no coincidence both of those teams are in the semi-finals. England could have possibly had more warm-up games in India. They had a 12-day gap, I think, between the end of the New Zealand series and flying out to India. There could have been a chance of going out to India 5 days early and playing a couple more games. Could have done, but then you get to the workload question again. Could the players physically do it? And in terms of warm-up games in general, you mentioned McCullum and Stokes. I mean, warm-up games have completely gone out the window under their leadership of the test team. And you can look at it and say, well, England have transformed themselves. They're now brilliant to watch. And results-wise, you can't argue. But you look at the India tour coming up after Christmas, England have no warm-up games for the first test in Hyderabad. They go to the UAE for a training camp. They're not playing any warm-up games before they fly to India. And you just think, how are they going to go into that series so unprepared and have a chance of winning? You never know, because the way they play, it's just kind of, you know, maybe it'll work. But I can't see anything other than a heavy defeat for England. It's probably going to take them a couple of tests just to get into the rhythm of cricket in India and getting used to the conditions, I'd think.
Well, they won't have played test cricket for quite a long time either, would they? They've not played any test matches since the back end of July, and then they're expected to go into the absolute hotbed of a series in India. Management of this team, you mentioned about Rob Key. Rob Key seems to be doing a lot of defensive talking of the team, but Matthew Mott recently, and I think you highlighted, he gave a very terse press conference, and I don't think helped himself or helped the cause by responding in the way he did to questions with one-word answers and figurative shrugging of the shoulders. Is that something that needs to be worked on?
I don't know how you can work on that, but in terms of Matthew Mott, the more he spoke during the World Cup, the worse it got for him, because the results weren't getting any better. I mean, you mentioned the two wins at the end, but all the pressure really had gone, hadn't it? They were playing for, what, Champions Trophy qualification, which in normal times, with England not being as competent as they were, would be an absolute given. So he got worse as the tournament went on in terms of communicating with us. And you just wonder, what is his communication like with the players behind closed doors? If you're that terse and you're speaking so unimpressively, what the hell is he like inside that dressing room? I think he's lucky to survive the sack from this World Cup campaign. I know it's not all down to the coach. There are other factors. And Rob Key kind of threw himself over Matthew Mott and took a hit for him, saying, you know, it's not his fault. But I think Matthew Mott's very, very lucky not to be paying the price for this World Cup campaign.
Yeah, Owen Morgan on commentary, he did more than hint that he thought that there was unrest in the dressing room. And it wasn't just once, it was a few times he sort of talked about this and expanded on it when he was given the opportunity. But he definitely felt that something was wrong. And for a team to fall so highly from grace was primarily, he thought, down to something going on in the dressing room. Maybe Mott might have his fingerprints on this. But I know the players have come out and said, no, everything's fine, but they would say that, wouldn't they? There seems to, we seem to be at a point now where there kind of need to be a reset of the white ball team, the 50-over team. And added to that was this farce about the contracts being announced midway through. What was the thinking there?
Well, the thinking there was the fact that we were introducing these new multi-year deals. It took a lot longer to sort than it would have done ordinarily under the old system, where it was just annual central contracts. That led to a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between the PCA, the England Player Partnership, and lawyers, just hammering down the terms of these contracts. So it dragged into the World Cup campaign. You had the situation, I think it was 2 days before the Sri Lanka game, where all these contracts were finally announced. The decision to announce them then, Rob Key told us, was because he was worried that if he left it any longer, the media would be leaked the details of these contracts, which is remarkable, really, but that's where we were with it. And, you know, the headline from that announcement was Ben Stokes has rejected a 3-year deal and has only taken a 12-month deal. And then, of course, David Willey was the only bloke in that squad who hadn't landed a contract at all. So they deny that caused any unrest or in the camp. But you look at David Willey announces his retirement, you know, 2 weeks before the end of the tournament, saying he's going to quit after the World Cup. That doesn't suggest a completely happy camp, and it also doesn't suggest that the timing of that contract announcement was wise.
Yeah, and I wonder about players having too much power. It's getting a little bit football-like now, and I'm just wondering whether Rob Key and the ECB are kind of trying to bend over to accommodate players going and playing franchise cricket and not necessarily being tied to the England shirt. But I mean, if we go down that route, then we're only going to see further disasters at tournament level.
Yeah, I mean, remarkably, these contracts are announced sort of midway through a really, really terrible campaign for England, and you've got a lot of players who, on the face of it, you look at now and say they probably haven't got a future, at least in 50 over cricket. I'm talking David Malan, who's been dropped for that upcoming tour of the Caribbean. Adil Rashid is not in the one-day squad for that tour, nor is Moeen Ali, nor is Chris Wokes. These guys are all on deals. And you've got the likes of Phil Salt, Will Jacks. You'd think two players who are going to be part of the future of the one-day team and the T20 team, not on deals at all. They were brought in to kind of stave off the threat of players signing deals with IPL franchises and their various other teams they have around the globe. But the young promising players, or the younger promising players, a lot of them aren't on deals, so they can walk off. Will Jackson walk off and say, do you know what, I'm not going to play in the next one-day series, whenever it is. I'm going to go and play in the Pakistan Super League or the IPL or the IL T20. So I think the contract thing was a bit of a mess. They went too early, I think, on offering old players long deals, and they spent an awful lot of money on it as well.
Yeah, and does that mean that they're kind of handcuffed to these guys on deals? You know, are they going to be pushed into picking them because they're paying them rather than trying to explore new talent?
Well, you would kind of think so, but Milan is a prime example. He's literally just, the ink's barely dry on his one-year deal, and he's effectively been told he's not going to play for England again. You know, Rob Key said never say never, but he's not in the one-day squad, and he won't be in the future. He's 36. And in the T20 squad, he's not in that either. He's been told he needs to up his game if he wants to get recalled before the World Cup. So effectively, Milan is being paid a year's money, several hundred thousands of pounds, for probably not playing any cricket for England, which is remarkable, really.
I'm comparing it to 2015, where we were a similar... Oh, excuse me. Yeah. 2015, we had a miserable World Cup where we didn't get out of the group stage. And the team was reset, and it was the last time we saw the likes of Ravi Bapar at the time, to name one. But there were a few that weren't part of the process going forward to 2019. So there was a plan in place pretty much from the word go in that. But, you know, for the next World Cup in South Africa, the planning does look to be even more muddled than ever. And I think these contracts aren't making things easier at all for the way England are going to sort of set the roadmap out. Who do you think, let's try and put a positive spin on this, who has come out of this with credit, and where's the future looking for England, let's say for the next 12 months? You mentioned a couple of names, but who comes out of the World Cup with any credit?
Well, funnily enough, the one batsman you think comes out of credit is David Milan, and he actually did okay. The average 45, I think, and scored a 100 and did all right, but he's not going to be seen again. Adil Rashid, look at his figures. He got 15 wickets at 26 or 27. Did really, really well, but he's obviously 35 and not one for the future. I think Harry Brook, him actually not playing for quite a few of the games has made him look better. He actually did. He was the only batsman who stood up against Afghanistan in that game in Delhi where they lost. He is the future of English white ball cricket, and that one day team in particular needs to be built around Harry Brook, I would say. And then you've got the other younger guys coming through. I think Will Jacks in particular is a guy I love the look of. England like him. He can bat as an opener. He can probably bat down the order as well, depending on the balance of the team. We've got Phil Salt, we've got Rian Ahmed, who's been selected for that Caribbean tour, and you think he's such an exciting talent that he needs to be nurtured over the next 4 years and kind of given the game's time, especially in one day cricket, to kind of find his rhythm in that, and could be a potential superstar ahead of that 2027 World Cup. There is the talent in England. We have a huge depth of white ball talent, so it just needs to be, there needs to be a plan, effectively, like there was between 15 and 19. There needs to be a proper plan put in place so that come the next World Cup, the next ODI World Cup in 2027, England are rebuilt properly with a younger squad. They actually got a proper game plan. Everyone in that team knows their roles, and they can actually make a decent fist of the tournament and not, you know, go down in a ball of flames like they did in this one.
And what about Rhys Topley, who had his injury problems, but since he's sort of got his way through all that, his luck's been awful. You know, getting treading on a Toblerone boundary rope, advertising foam sponge, injuring himself, and then in this tournament, doing really well. But a freak accident in fielding off his own bowling. But I think if he can stay fit, he should be part of the team going forward as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned kind of how unlucky Rhys has been. We spoke to him after the Bangladesh game, which was England's second game of the tournament, and Rhys did really well in that. He'd been actually been dropped for the, well, not been picked for the opening game, unbelievably, but was recalled for that second game and did really well. And we were speaking to him after that, and he was mentioning, you know, how unlucky he's been, and he was hoping this World Cup would be a change in fortunes for him, and he was looking forward to it. And then two games later, yeah, as you say, he breaks a finger trying to make a catch off his own bowling, and the poor guy's sent home. But in terms of long-term thinking, I think Reece is definitely a guy we should look at for that next World Cup in 2027, because if he can stay fit, he should be the leader of that attack, I would say. And he'll be young enough, I think, about 33 when that tournament starts, to make it as well. So let's just hope he has an extended run without injuring himself, and a run of games, and hopefully he can be the kind of leader of that attack going forward.
Yeah, it's funny. I read something about his injury history might actually go in his favour, because despite his age, whatever it is, he hasn't actually played. You know, he hasn't got, if he was a car, he hasn't got very many miles on the clock. So, you know, keeping fit and injury free, and a turn of good luck as well would help. And I think he certainly is there for the next 4 years, definitely. Overall, then, on this World Cup, if you want to just sort of sum it up in a nutshell, how was the tournament, and who do you think has stood out overall, away from England, who have been the star performers, and have you got a magical moment that will stick with you when you look back to 2023?
Yeah, I mean, for all the lack of organisation, and you could also say there's been a lack of close games as well, it's still been a Cricket World Cup, and there has been some fantastic moments and some fantastic cricket. I mean, this is going out obviously before the final on Sunday, but India have looked a level above everybody else. I mean, the way they've not only played their cricket, but withstood the pressure of that, you know, 1.4 billion home fans kind of expecting them to win this tournament. The way they've done that has been so impressive. And you look at someone like Mohammed Shami, I mean, for me, he is the man of the tournament at the moment. He's just been amazing. In terms of magic moments, I mean, I wasn't there on the ground, but I was watching on TV. The Glenn Maxwell double 100 against Afghanistan was just remarkable innings. And by the end, he was making it look easy, even though he kind of could barely move. For me, that's a magical moment, but you never know, Darren, there might be a few more magical moments before Sunday evening.
Well, let's just hope that it's a close game, and it's a game worthy of the final. I know one of the other criticisms of this tournament is there have been far too many one-sided games and hardly any down to the wires, but let's hope that on Sunday we do get something that's going to be worthy of the occasion. Chris, I will let you crack on. Are you off to the Caribbean with England next month?
No, I'm not. My next assignment is India after Christmas for those test matches.
So back again. All right, well, many thanks for joining us. Look after yourself, and we'll speak soon. It's Chris Stocks from The Independent.
Cheers, Darren. Thanks, mate.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
My thanks to Chris for a really good interview there. We covered quite a lot of ground, but he's been out there, and quite interesting to hear his views from first-hand coverage of the Cricket World Cup. Right, time to put in some county news now. Long-serving batter Wayne Matson has signed a new two-year contract with Derbyshire that will extend his time at the county to 16 full seasons. The South Africa-born 39-year-old joined Derbyshire in August 2009 and is second on their all-time list of run scorers with 20,930 runs across all formats. He was top scorer in the county championship in 2022 and hit more than 500 runs in the T20 Blast last season. His new contract will take him through to the end of the 2025 campaign. Ben Mike has returned to Leicestershire on a three-year contract after just 1 year at Yorkshire. The 25-year-old rejected a contract offer to remain at Leicestershire in summer of 2022, instead committing to 3 years at Headingley. At the time, Darren Goff, Yorkshire's managing director, said he hailed Mike's potential and said, "We have signed him purely on talent." It didn't really work out. He struggled to break into Yorkshire's county championship side, therefore prompting his decision to return to Grace Road in search of regular Red Bull cricket. Warwickshire captain Will Rhodes has stepped down as Bears skipper after 4 years in the role. 28-year-old Yorkshireman wants to concentrate on his game after seeing his Hall of County Championships runs drop for the second season in succession. Rhodes had been at Edgbaston for 6 years since arriving from his native Yorkshire in 2018, and he took over captaincy for the COVID-hit 2020 season following the retirement of Jeetan Patel. The 100... Yes, Richard Clark, your favourite. Reports, well, it's confirmed now, Andrew Flintoff will be appointed as the head coach of the Northern Superchargers next summer, which will be his first formal cricket role since his serious accident last year filming for Top Gear. He was involved with England over the summer, and I'm sure we all saw those photos of him helping out on warm-up activities for the England team. Now, he replaces former Essex legend James Foster. Down at the Big Bash, a blow with England star Harry Brook withdrawing from the tournament due to his increased international commitments, having been the second pick for Melbourne Stars in the overseas draft. They had hoped that he would be available for 7 games in between, but due to England's tour of India, he was then added to England's T20 and ODI squads for the white ball tour of the Caribbean in December, so it's just too much. Therefore, Brook has withdrawn due to the workload. Well, that's it for this week. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, where all the best bits and the best interviews are there. There's also a YouTube channel if you want to get the visual interpretation of the show. John Chubb is up next with the non-league hour, and then Madeline Christie's here at 10. And in between them, 8 till 10, is Gareth Williams and Bumper to Bumper. Keep it locked to Phoenix. I'll be back next Thursday at 6 o'clock, hopefully a bit more organised. Playing us out tonight, here's Chic, and this is My Feet Keep Dancing.
Across Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
News.